Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. My name is Nick Argyris and I'm looking for the best book by a billionaire. They know how to write good books, I'm
well,
sure.
Alliteration is right.
This is not going to end poorly at all.
Oh, yeah. Best book by billionaires, Nick. I brought a billionaire this morning. Excuse me. I have a frog in my throat. I brought a billionaire this morning with me right now from the grave. I brought Sam Walton's book that he wrote in like 1992.
Should I know who Sam Walton is?
Oh, you do. Okay. Even if you don't know who Sam Walton is, you have definitely purveyed of the things that made him a billionaire. You have perhaps shopped at a little store called Sam's Club. No, I'm just kidding. Walmart is the famous one. Walmart's the famous
one. Sam's Club would have been great.
Yeah.
Walmart, huh?
Okay. Yeah, Walmart. Oh, and also Sam's Club and also some other stuff.
Oh, and also, is it named after him? Is Sam's Club named after him?
He made two very famous stores and named them both
Walton.
After him.
They're both named after him.
I would like to name like a store of mine Ian World, possibly. Right.
Well, you just kind of become a billionaire. That's a good story.
Well, you actually start the store first and then you become a billionaire. It's all in the book, guys.
Well, no, your parents have to name you first.
Oh, yeah. First, your parents name you.
No, but then you start your parents have to be named and then they can.
Oh, anyway, it goes all the way down.
Good morning, scholars. My name is Cha-ching Nick. Cha-ching Joe.
Rapper name.
Litheads. Okay. No, not rapper.
Is Cha-ching your rapper name?
No,
there's nothing about rap here. You guys remember how in early episodes I used to do raps? That was amazing. Maybe I should bring that back.
That was a good
For sure. It's not in the curriculum, but you can bring it back anytime you want.
Every time Ian did a rap, I felt terrible because I'm like, he does way more prep for these shows than I do. Right.
This week, I'm Dr. Dollars, the billionaire English teacher. That's my alter ego, and you can call me Dr. Dollars.
What about Double D?
Oh, yeah?
I'll allow it. Yep.
Yeah.
Double D is
Who wouldn't
also
want to be called Double D?
Precisely. Really this week, I brought Mackenzie Scott's American Book Award-winning novel, The Testing of Luther Albright.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Wait one second. So Mackenzie Scott, I know who this is.
Now this is
formerly Mackenzie
person.
Bezos,
right?
Correct?
Yes. Yep.
Right. And this is not a book about how she acquired her billions of dollars.
Nope,
my guess
it's
is
not.
It's a literary book. She wrote a book.
It's a literary book. Yeah. This is amazing. So the book that I'm on record as categorically hating this week's theme. And when Nick forced us to read books by billionaires, I wriggled under his harsh yoke, and I found a literary novel.
You are always wriggling under my harsh yoke. Always.
Yep. Yeah, that's true.
I'm trying to find loopholes. Mackenzie Scott is a billionaire, and she wrote a book. This is a book by a billionaire.
Not for long, though, right? Wow, she has $40 billion?
It's
never
so
mind.
Much.
She's going to have
we'll talk about her.
A couple billion.
We got stuff to say. Yeah. It's an interesting story.
It's hard to give that much away.
This billionaire donated tuition forever for this university.
Yeah,
was that her?
No, it's a different.
No,
one. It was.
So
a, I think
I'm
was,
like,
think
well,
it was a
how
black
the
billionaire?
F- how did
or
she
to
do
an
it?
HBCU.
Yeah, the details are unimportant. The interesting part was that it was like she gave it for, or the person gave it forever. Mm. Meaning, I'm like, well, how is that possible? How much money could she have given forever? But the number of people that are admitted to the school, which is only like 150 people a year, the interest from the $1 billion she donated will pay for everyone's tuition forever. Just the interest.
Yep.
It's like 35 million or something.
It could pay for a football stadium. Like one or the other.
These days it can pay for like half of a football
Both
stadium.
Admirable.
So, This is Ruth Gottesman. Her husband got in on Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway stuff, and so she donated $1 billion. And
the interest
will provide
she was a widow.
Free tuition. This is an interesting little piece of academia. It's It's the endowment. So this is basically the lump of cash that big fancy universities have sitting. And some universities have massive endowments.
Yeah.
It's maybe like Harvard or Yale. One of the big Ivies has a $33 billion endowment.
Yeah.
And to some extent, this is like people just donate money and they have to spend it on what it's donated for, earmarked for. But there's also like they're investing it. So like Harvard is an investor in, you know, fracking and oil companies. And this causes friction between the students and faculty who are not always down with sort of big business.
Notably pro-fracking, most students.
Most universities, yes.
Yeah. Students walk in and say, those fracking bucks, baby.
Yeah.
So the endowment controversy is a big one, and it gets even bigger when a university says, I'm so sorry. We need to cut the
insert small
department here. And the response is often, well, you do have $33 billion sitting in the bank. Could you use some of that for this? And they always answer, no, we couldn't. But we know that accounting is fiction, so they totally could.
Yeah. Well, and you kind of
really
understand
spelled
that.
That out.
And you understand that like logic. But this happened in the state of Wisconsin a few years ago. The state of Wisconsin has traditionally a very strong education system, and the University of Wisconsin is traditionally a strong system. And then... I mean, I don't know. I don't want to get too much into it, but a while ago, the government was like, hey, University of Wisconsin-Madison, you have a pretty large endowment. We are going to start underfunding quite a bit of the money that we give you. And how about you spend your own money on it? Which felt skeezy and gross, and people didn't like it. But also,
what's like, the skeezy gross part? It's a state-funded school. That's would be the difference between that and like a Harvard, right?
Sure, but like I think the University of Wisconsin comes out and says, sure, but our endowment is money that we've gone out and like hustled up from our donors. Like those are people who have like left and been like, hey, we want you to spend this on a, you know, chemistry program or whatever the case is.
The idea is with endowments, oftentimes they are earmarked and they're supposed to be for sort of like capital improvements. They're not supposed to be for operating expenses.
Well, I'm going to be playing your local billionaire today, and I just don't think... I think we should cut school funding, is what I'm saying. I guess that's where I'm landing on this.
Teachers get paid too
much. Sounds like
they
have enough money. I think they'll be fine.
I will say, I'm looking at a list of endowments right now. The Yales and Harvards are $40 billion, $50 billion. Harvard, $50 billion. Yale, $40 billion. Stanford, $36 billion. Okay. Public schools... with endowment.
How many
billion? University of Texas has $45 billion.
That's surprising. That's wild. All these oil billionaires.
And so you still feel good about that, Joe? They shouldn't
Texas
be tapping. They shouldn't
is
be
number
tapping
two
into
on
that.
The list. Michigan's really high. University of Wisconsin-Madison, number 14 on the list of public schools, $3.8 billion.
I think they should tax it, give it back to themselves. Well, welcome, Lynette. See you to know later. We call it Strongly Podcast, where every week we pick a theme, or you do. And Joe and Ian, two high school English teachers, bring book recommendations, or you do. And we do have, we haven't had two books in a while, I feel like. And I'm excited to see one of you lose and wiggle under my yoke.
Too.
Wiggle under my yoke?
Yeah. Well, wriggle, but I kind of like the idea of wiggle.
Yeah, wiggle. I'm liking wiggling under my yoke, Ian, please. Thank you. Okay, no spoilers. Rule number two, Joe, that's enough story time. Rule number three, only winning matters. Joseph, what is your... Give me the back cover of your book.
All right, Nick. Success has always had its price, and Sam Walton learned that the hard way in 1985 when Forbes named him the richest man in America. While the newspaper and TV folks in New York were saying who and he lives where, reporters and photographers flocked to Bentonville, Arkansas. Walton wasn't what they were expecting to see. They maybe wanted to see him diving into a swimming pool full of money or lighting cigars with $100 bills while these are Walton's words, the hoochie coochie girls danced by the lake. What they actually saw was a man who drove an old pickup truck with room for his bird dogs, who wore a Walmart ball cap everywhere who he went, and who got his haircut at the local barber. Made in America is Sam Walton's story in his own words.
Oh,
I think those last three words No, four words.
In his own words.
I think that's essential to what this story is going to do.
It's every autobiography, isn't it? It's like, allow me to tell you why I am actually quite smart and not bad.
Ian, I feel like you're going to be poking holes in this guy's story, and I'm going to be pro Sam Walton. Good for this guy. The American dream, Ian. Wow.
It's very bootstrappy. Wait till you hear about the bootstraps, guys.
I have no section. Knowledge.
Ian, quiet. Tell us about your book.
A Broken Home is a Catastrophe. This is the fear of Luther Albright, a Sacramento dam builder with a picture-perfect life and a pretty sad backstory. Of course, since I brought a literary novel this week, Broken Home has dual significance as Luther struggles to find the sewage issues in the house he built for his family. He gradually alienates his wife and son. This is a psychological domestic novel that reads a little bit like horror, and it's very different from what Joe brought. This is The Testing of Luther Albright by Mackenzie Scott.
Joe, I feel like my hope for Ian is that I want the book to be good, but my hope is that like he got angry and he went off theme a little bit, right? And tried to find like a good billionaire. And
sure.
It's like the book wasn't very good.
Oh, sure. Well, I I don't know very much about Mackenzie Scott, but I root for her. It was among the first people on the planet to realize that Jeff Bezos is a huge dork, clearly.
Well, I feel like when you're married to Jeff Bezos, and then Jeff Bezos does all the Jeff Bezos things, you're kind of like a built-in fan base. Because people who root against Jeff, you kind of have two options. Is it Jeff or McKenzie? And so she's the beneficiary of his dorkiness in that. She's always presented as the less dorky individual in that sort of, and they're not married anymore, but we still think of them as together.
Yeah. You know what blows my mind?
Let's just start with her. Can I just
talk about Jeff Bezos, like riding horses and wearing cowboy hats and stuff like that?
Yeah, that way. Yeah, for sure.
This is a book about a sad boy. Well, a sad man. He is deeply neurotic and deeply repressed.
He has daddy
issues. He's middle-aged, baby.
Middle-aged.
Oh.
The best age, right, guys?
He's late. He's late middle-aged.
He's got a
teenage son. He's been working at the dam company for 27 years. So he kind of has, it seems like when the book begins, he seems like he's got it together in his life seems to others, it seems to him and it seems to us that he's got it together. But as the book progresses, kind of we have these parallel strains. We get more information about his growing up, which is dreadful. He's got like the stereotypical dad who won't talk and mom who is withdrawn. And he just really doesn't want to become his dad. And as the book progresses, you kind of see him becoming his dad. So that's why I say it's like a horror book, because there are over these moments where you're like, dude, your son is trying to connect with you.
Right.
Why don't you talk to him? And then he doesn't. It's like, you know, like the thing in horror movies where you're like, don't go in there. Don't open the door. Don't split up. And they always do. This happens over and over. Yeah. So the book begins with like, he kind of tells this in a flashback, flash forward style. So he begins by saying, during this time period, my son tested me in 9 different ways. And he sees this as his son trying to like, there's a little bit of paranoia. Like my son's kind of trying to get me. He's out to get me. He's trying to sort of like show me up as imperfect.
Okay.
And then our main character, Luther, just narrates this from his perspective. And over the course of the story, the relationship with the son kind of degrades. The relationship with his wife kind of degrades too. And it's not a downer. It's just sad.
It sounds like a regular ass book. Do you know what
it's
I mean?
It's a bookie book.
It sounds like, and here's some people, and they're, is this like a coming of age story? What
it's
is
not,
this?
It is a domestic drama. It's not, this is the strange thing. I normally hate this kind of book. This is the kind of book where like
no lasers or anything.
Relational not problems. Robot, like, oh robots, my goodness, my
monsters.
My son. Yeah, there's nothing fun about it. It's just like,
yeah,
me and my wife, our son comes downstairs. He's shaved his head. We have to figure out how to deal with it. And like,
what's the overt lesson then?
Don't be closed off. Read Brennan Brown's book, Daring Greatly, Be Vulnerable. Like his big issue, his big problem is that he is so unwilling to have open conversations there. Moment after moment, he has the opportunity to connect, to be honest. And he even says this, like, at that moment, I totally should have said, honey, I love you and I'm scared, but I didn't. I talked about the weather instead.
Is this a lot of inner monologue?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's first person. And that's what makes this, I think, so gripping is that it's not an oblivious first person narrator. He is aware of how he's screwing up kind of in live time. We get to see his regrets unfold kind of as he's doing the things that he regrets.
Well, but I do think that's like kind of identifiable, right? Like when you lose your patience with somebody or when you, you know, whatever, when you're acting like your dad, whatever it is, like a lot of times you do see it happening as it's happening and think like, oh,
yeah.
Wish I could take that back. Right. Yes. Like, yes.
I say this in class all the time. Like I talk about, I make jokes that don't land
it's got to be constantly, right?
Yeah, constantly.
I think all teachers do, but it really has to happen to Ian.
They call me can't stick the landing DeYoung.
Right.
But I talk to my students.
Grayson's over here.
Mm-hmm. Can you ever tell, do you ever have that feeling where you regret something as you're saying it? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what the book is representing. I think this is a point where I can kind of talk about the style, because a big part of what is the style. Go ahead, Nick. What's your question?
Yep.
What are some ways that we can be less closed off, Ian?
When your son takes you to a movie theater, which is showing a movie about father and a son connecting, and he's desperately trying to connect with you.
Yeah.
Don't talk about the FDA's new sweetener that they're trying to get pushed through. Like, he is so bad at this that to some extent it's kind of like, oh, well, I would never do that. I'm too emotionally honest. I would never. But it's also very real. So I'm going to talk about the style now. I'm going to talk about style. And there's nothing you can do to stop me.
I'll trim this down, lit heads. Don't worry.
So this book is written from Luther's perspective, the point of view of the repressed person. So we get to see him, like I say, acknowledging his mistakes, whether it's in the moment or in retrospect. But this is really interesting because I feel like you don't often see the person with the sort of emotional stuntedness being the point of view character, the main character.
Right.
Because that requires them to acknowledge their emotional stuntedness, and the act of acknowledgement, we imagine, would lead you naturally not to do those emotionally stunted things. So Scott manages in this book to kind of like have her cake and eat it too, where we have this main character who is stunted, emotionally stunted, but also is self-aware enough to realize it. And that makes it even more torturous, because it's not just that he doesn't have like good family connections.
It's just a book of regrets. He's just,
it's a huge book of regrets. He realizes it's wrenching. And I think, so the other piece of this is it's got these flashbacks and flash forwards, which has the effect of making us not clear always on like where we are in time, but it gives you enough background for what's happening at the right time. And it also mimics human memory. So if I want to tell you about something that happened 3 years ago, I'm not going to just like jump back to 3 years and say, so it was the evening of the Super Bowl and the 49ers are playing the Chiefs and Nick called me and he was a few sheets to the wind. He said, we should do a podcast together. And that's one of the beauties of this book. I think it really kind of cleanly mimics the way human minds work. in terms of memory, in terms of guilt, in terms of regret, in terms of sort of like watching relationships unfold, and in terms of uncertainty.
So Mackenzie Scott, I'll just start here. I didn't know she was an author. I guess I didn't know anything about her before she started donating billions of dollars.
Right. Was she an author first? Was she?
I assume she was an author first. This came out in 2005, right?
This is a beautiful segue to talk about her. So I think she is fascinating. She had this kind of well-to-do upbringing, went to big fancy schools, studied at print.
Her maiden name is Tuttle, which feels like one of those like fancy old names, doesn't it? Yeah. Like Mackenzie Scott Tuttle.
Yeah.
Tuttle. Well, she's named, a Tuttle.
Yeah, oh, she's named a Tuttle. After her grandfather. one of the Tuttles of Connecticut, you say?
Right.
So she studied creative writing at Princeton. So she's an English major, baby. Her mentor there was a little person I like to call Toni Morrison.
Oh, we've heard of Toni Morrison. She got Sula, beloved.
Was she a professor there?
Yeah, she was a teacher of creative writing. I did a double take because I was like, wait, I mean, I know billionaires are billionaires. Billionaires gonna billionaire, but the Toni Morrison, like the massive award-winning, like huge, absolutely. Right,
the literary genius. Yeah.
Furthermore, she was like close with Morrison to the extent that after she graduated, she was a research assistant for Morrison when Morrison was writing the book Jazz, which I brought to the podcast quite some time ago. So like she was involved with kind of the production of not just like fiction, but literary fiction. I think it's fascinating. And then she gets married to Jeff and the two of them start Amazon together. She was apparently a big part of the early years of Amazon.
Really?
She was like, to the extent that when they divorced, I didn't enjoy this part of it, but I did a little bit of research into it. When they divorced, the courts found that Amazon was to some extent what's called community property. That is property created by the two of them over the course of their marriage. So that's why she got 4% of Amazon, which is translated to $40 billion because she was deemed to be important enough to like the growth and
this would not have happened without you, right, Mackenzie Scott?
I was reading some comments about this book, some reviews earlier in the week, and I ran across some people saying like stop talking about her as just the ex-wife who got a bunch of money. That's not what she did. Not like Jeff didn't get a prenup, and so she grabbed some of his cash. She was apparently in at the ground floor, one of those kind of key. You know, like the myth of Apple is that Steve Jobs did everything himself, but we know he didn't.
Right.
Kind of the same situation where these massive kind of titans, they were able to do their big things because of the help of people alongside of them. So she now has $40 billion. She's the third wealthiest American woman. She does a ton of charity. So far, she's given away at least $14 billion to... Wow. Over 1,000 different charitable organizations. So I don't think there is such a thing as an ethical billionaire, but she's doing her darndest.
Reading this, like I'm just looking at the page of her philanthropy and it's just so many things, like just gave money to this, gave money to this, gave money to this. And like the numbers all, you know, end with billion. And it just seems so weird. It seems like once you have $40 billion, it seems like almost nothing you do can stop you from having $40 billion, right? Because she's like, it seems like she cannot give this away. Like, I'm just like $2 billion, $12 billion, $5 billion, $14 billion, $2.7 billion. I'm like, she has $40 billion. It's like, what? Yep. Did she start with $700 billion?
It's not a pool that's going to diminish. Like at a certain point, you kind of hit that. You hit that tipping where nothing, you can't give it away. You are unable to give it away faster than it comes in.
All right. You got $40 billion. You're going to give it away. How much are you keeping? Two?
Well, like, I can't.
Five? If I had $40 billion, I think I'm giving away 35.
Sure, $5 billion.
The rest is going to like the rest of my lineage.
I would say for me, it depends on how I got that. Because if I was given it, that's different from if I made it. You know,
you have it ethically.
Okay, but still, like, I think we have a greater attachment.
You're no fun. Ian's not playing. No, are you going to buy a jet ski or what, Ian?
Well, obviously, I'll buy a jet ski. Yeah, obviously. Yes. Obviously. But I would definitely keep like five, and I would get rid of the rest.
I think I would just keep one billion dollars.
I mean, the question is how much will make you happy? What's the price of happiness, really? No, it's like how much will have that continuing effect of it keeps coming interest. In no matter what. Yes, you know, that's the word, interest.
There's a great quote, and I'm going to mangle the context of this, but it was some Texas oil billionaire who was asked about, you know, his falling number on the Forbes 400 list or whatever, but he still had, you know, $1 billion or something. And they asked him how he felt about it. And he said, you know, $1 billion just ain't what it used to be.
Yep. I thought you were going to do the, I think it's a Rockefeller quote. Enough is just a little bit more.
Enough is just a lot more.
That's real. That's real punchy. I love that one. I have one more thing
to say
about
this. Much better than Joe's.
Oh yeah. Sorry, Joe. One more thing to say about this. And this is so like, and this is maybe not very kind of me. There's a temptation to read this book.
Bleep it out.
Knowing what we know about Scott and the eventual end of her marriage with Bezos, because Bezos is a huge dork. There's a temptation to read this.
Do you think he could communicate his feelings well?
Is this biographical or autobiographical? The wife character, Liz, in this book is beautiful, very kind and loving, very, very sweet, devoted to the kids. And amazing. The husband's kind of like distant.
Involved with his business called Mamazon.
Very good at his job, but not always makes him
always present. Like,
I don't love the autobiographical approach to reading, to interpreting, but as I read this, I had to wonder, like,
has she commented?
I don't think so. There's a lot of distance
between this book and her and the end of their relationship. They got divorced in like 20. It was like the late 2019.
But this is not a book about the end of their marriage. This is a book about the gradual distance growing between them.
Well, to be clear, it's not a book about Mackenzie Bezos at all, Ian. This is a book about a guy who built sales.
This is different. Right. His name is Luther Albrecht. He's a dude. She's a lady. What's the... But
she wrote this book about a man and a fish, a mega man and his day.
She wrote this book over the first 10 years of their marriage while she was kind of like, and the reason it took her 10 years, she has said, is because she was juggling Amazon duties and taking care of the kids. They have three kids and an adopted kid. And Jeff is kind of, by 2005, when this comes out, Amazon is kind of starting to pop off as like the place.
Yeah.
Well, you heard it here first. You can read this as a one-to-one translation about the day-to-day life of Jeff Bezos.
I'm not suggesting that. I am curious the extent to which...
Official recommendation. Sam Walton.
Sam?
I'm looking at a picture of this guy.
Walton.
And he
looks like a billionaire.
Yeah.
Looks like America's wealthiest man.
It's very like that 1970s, 80 businessman suit. Yeah, kind of like, I'm a winner. And this is my book about being a winner. Is that what?
He's also one of those guys who was born old. So let's run them down. Stan Lee, born old.
Great.
Sam Walton,
born old. Christopher Lee.
Yep.
Born old.
Yeah, I mean like
Jean-Luc Picard. Born old. Yeah. He looks like he loves baseball caps. So he's loves in every picture he has caps. A suit on and then a hat with his corresponding business.
Well, he famously got his hair cut at the local barber in Bentonville, Arkansas. So I assume he'd never had a very good haircut. So he just like threw his ball cap on when he left.
High and tight, Joe.
So this is Sam Walton. Sam Walton is he was rich. He was real rich. In fact, he was so rich that when he died, so he was like the wealthiest person in America or close to the wealthiest person in America when he died in like 1992, I want to say something like that. The early 90s.
92 at the age of 74.
When he died, his four children all took his place on the list of the wealthiest people in America. Like they split up his fortune four ways. And then instead of him being the second wealthiest, they were like the fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh.
That's amazing.
Isn't one of them the owner of the Denver Broncos?
Sure, probably. You're going to buy a team for sure.
Yeah, you got to. By the way, if you want to know how Sam Walton would feel about buying a football team, he would hate it. He would think that was you flaunting your money. Ooh. You were being ridiculous.
He sounds like old school classy, Joe.
It's also a good investment. Because
sure, it's a good investment, but you know what's a better investment is opening up a few more Walmart stores.
So he has a good very point. Clear, like, one-to-one, like, the way you do it is this.
So that's one of the interesting things about Sam Walton, and I guess, let me start with this book.
It's going to be the theme for this next couple minutes, I think.
The interesting thing about Sam Walton, yeah. Okay, the way this book came to be is Sam Walton got a cancer diagnosis, right? He was 74 years old. They said, hey, you have cancer. You are not going to live through this. And he said, boy, I've always really meant to write down my story. I've always really meant to write my book. So he got, he did not write this, right? Like, he gave a series of extended interviews with a writer. And he talked about everything from his personal life, like the early days of Walmart, growing the business, building the team around it, company culture, his kids, his philanthropy. Like, this book touches on basically, this is Sam Walton being like, if I had to say it all, this is what I want in the book. Like, I want to talk about this. I want to talk about this. I want to talk about this.
Interesting. That,
those interviews, and they are published pretty much as like the interview. Like, it's just Sam Walton speaking in these long paragraphs, right?
Who's this person, Joe?
Who's the writer of it?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Okay. Yeah. You know, because as you mentioned it, I looked it up here. Walter Isaacson is the famous, you know, billionaire.
Yeah, that's the guy. Yeah, billionaire profiler.
Profiler that takes him years to, you know.
Yeah.
Said he got it when he was 74.
Yeah, this does not feel like that. Like, this is not Walter Isaacson, like, hanging out with Elon Musk or whoever he's hanging out with for 5 years. This is Sam Walton being like, I have less than a year to live. Give me a reporter. Right? Give me somebody to talk to. That reporter, that writer, then went out and interviewed basically anybody that Sam talked about. So he interviewed his wife, his children, his business associates, like the people that ran those early Walmart stores, et cetera. And those interviews, like the snippets of those interviews, are just published right alongside what Sam says. Huh. So Sam will tell his story of what it was like when we opened up our fifth store and we did like this like crazy like promotional thing in the street when we got this ice cream machine and all this. And then that store manager will be like, oh my God, that ice cream machine was a disaster. It brought in people like crazy. We had to clean it every night. It's a cool book like that. Like, the texture and structure of this book is
cool. So how does he come across?
Well, it's his self-sanctioned autobiography. He comes across as...
So there's no moments where he's like, with the interviewees are like, Sam used to come in and slap us in the face. And then he has his story where he's like, I always gave them a crisp high five.
Okay.
There's no like contradiction there.
No, Sam comes across as great. Like, the people who talk about Sam seem like they really admire Sam Walton. Like, they say things like,
his charming was only as matched by his cunning.
I mean, they say things like, hey, he was a pain in the ass to work with, and he was incredibly demanding, and he was like often disorganized, he was so good at what he did. Like, only Sam could have done it. Yeah. So Sam comes across as painted in a very flattering light.
So the book came out before he died or after?
I think shortly after. Like, the book published in 1993. He dies in 92. Like, I just assume takes a while to put things together and finalize those interviews.
What with the editing and printing? Yeah,
sure. Right. The typing is the hard part.
Every single book. Is this like Art of War style? What about
is he telling us how to become a billionaire?
Yeah. Is this Art of War, or is this when I was a boy, I love that we're all doing our old man voices.
We should do a whole episode in old man voice.
I used to skip down the sidewalk, and that's why I invented Walmart.
Okay, a weekly podcaster. We take two books and we mush them together.
It's terrible.
It's a little of both.
It's a little of both.
This book is like, it's Sam Walton's autobiography, but this book is the story of Walmart. Right? Like Sam Walton's autobiography is an autobiography of Walmart.
Sorry,
the two are,
let's just get clean audio on me booing you. Okay, that sounds really lame.
Okay, it does sound really lame, but because he remembers those personal stories, he remembers like what a disaster those early stores were, but also like how they just seemed to make money hand over fist, no matter like where he put them, because he talks about the people that were involved and has like great little anecdotes with it and things like that. It's not lame. Like the story is pretty engaging, pretty gripping. There is some of the, when I was a little boy, I had a paper route stuff, right? That was the first buck I ever made. Well, Ian, why are you a billionaire?
Does he say, I didn't have a
paper route when I was a boy.
Is this at all interesting? Does this book get into any topics of substance?
Well, it's not going to spill any tea.
Well, I'm curious. It could inadvertently spill some tea. It could be, you know what I'm saying? Like there could be some interesting elements.
One of the things that blew my mind about this is, it's very strange to think about Walmart as anything besides the behemoth that we know it is today, right?
Sure.
Sam Walton started with, he franchised a five and dime store called Ben Franklin's, right? That was his first store.
Great name.
He like bought a five and dime. He opened it up in a market. He got it for a good price because it wasn't a particularly successful store. It had a lot of competition in town, and he built that store over the course of about 5 years into something that was successful and made money and stuff like that. And then he thought, hey, I think I know how to make these successful. I'm going to buy another five and dime Ben Franklin store. I'm going to buy another five and dime Ben Franklin store. He got a handful of those. And then eventually he hits on the idea, and this isn't his idea, but he sees that people like the Kmarts of the world, like the JCPenney's of the world, which, by the way, that guy's name is John Cash Penny. Did you know that that's what
I think I did. That's incredible. Yeah.
Wow. John Cash Penny. Like, he hits on the idea of discounting. And you'll understand the idea immediately because it's what we are used to when we go to Walmart or Target or whatever the case is. He says the five and dime model is bring in the stuff, sell it at your markup, that 45% markup, whatever it is, right? So get your stuff, sell it at a high markup. In discounting, the entire name of the game is passing on whatever savings you can get from the manufacturer to the customer. Right. So now, instead of having a 45% markup on things, he would have things in his stores that maybe had like a 30% markup or a 25% markup. Right.
He invented undercutting.
kind of like he did a lot of hustling on the supplier end in order to like get those savings. But rather than
pocket those savings,
he brought that directly to the customer. Now, that's not Sam Walton's idea, right? Like, he took that idea from somewhere else.
Sure.
Sam Walton's idea was, hey, all of these competitors, all of the Kmarts of the world, all of the JCPenney's of the world, they only open stores in large markets, right? Like, these stores won't even glance at a market if it doesn't have 25,000 people in the city, right? His idea was, I can make a Walmart. And these are Walmarts by now. He says, I can take a Walmart, I can put it in a town of 5,000 people, and that Walmart makes money, right? And then I can put another Walmart in another town of 5,000 people, and that Walmart makes money.
So he goes the opposite way. I'm going to destroy small towns first.
He goes the opposite way. He said everybody else would build these stores in these huge markets. And he said, and it was a pain in the ass to build them in huge markets because you had to deal with zoning and regulations and people would be against it. And there was a ton of competition.
There's still a thing about how there are no Walmarts in Chicago or New York. Like the big metro areas don't have them.
Convenience items. So they can take out like, they can replace like 10 stores. mm-hmm. being open.
That's exactly it. So he moved into these small markets, and that just ended up being a recipe for like explosive growth. And one of the interesting things about this book is watching Walmart go from a five and dime, literally the dime store that was on your local street in the town that you grew up in, to what we think of Walmart as today. And that happens over the course of one man's lifetime. And that's kind of wild and pretty impressive.
So it's like a villain origin story.
It's so easy to read this book. Like we know what Walmart is. We know how it like eviscerates the small towns that it goes into. We know how it like attracts the absolute worst of humanity. That's probably a little too strong. But like, we know what Walmart is. So it's so strange reading this book in which like Walmart is the hero. Like Walmart's like the face right. of this. And you, when you read it, you do look for holes. You know, you do look for the pieces where you're like, okay, but Sam Walton is actually a horrible bigot, right? But Sam Walton, throughout this entire book, which is an autobiography that he's writing at the end of his life, like with a supporting cast of characters who love him, right? He comes across a guy who is like really big on down home values, right? Who's very interested in raising his kids right with a lot of like kind of with as much discomfort as he can give them in their, you know, obviously billionaire lives. It comes across as pretty genuinely bootstrappy. Like he comes out of the army after World War II and he's saved $5,000 between like his paper route and then his work in college. And he uses that $5,000 to buy that first franchise, right? Like this is a guy who really does start with not much, right? So he comes across as humble. He comes across as thrifty. He comes across with a tremendous bias for like energetic action. He has a competitive spirit. Like he comes across as admirable.
Can I, can we end this with a Reddit comment?
Yes.
Please.
Okay. Okay, as I like to end all of my conversations.
On Reddit.
I think, yeah, we just need way more Reddit in this show. All right.
Absolutely.
The company's taken great pains to sanitize and deify his image in the three decades since his death. Most of what we know about Sam Walton today is modern myth, especially the idea that he was some kind of old man that loved his employees. He hated his workforce and constantly fought to keep wages and benefits down, prevented unionization, etc. The idea that we're all a necessary evil, a means to an end, and number on a spreadsheet didn't originate with his successors. It started with Sam Walton. It helps that the internet, as we know today, didn't exist until after he was gone. So there is essentially no wide public criticism of him from his own time.
Interesting.
It's great. And it's true, right? He directly responds to ideas like this because in the early 90s, these ideas were floating around. Sam Walton is anti-union. Sam Walton underpays his employees. Sam Walton, you know, like doesn't yeah. value these communities that he's going into.
Sure.
He directly responds to these allegations, and allegations is maybe strong, but he basically says like, look, Walmart's fallen under criticism over the years, right? He says, I get yelled at for not paying my employees enough. And he says, and look, for a lot of years, that was true, right? Like for a lot of years, like that was on me. That was true. He says, it was actually my wife and daughter that kind of talked me into like higher wages. He talked at length about like profit sharing plans that they have in place, right?
This is corporate jargon. This is corporate nonsense.
Okay. So yes, it's corporate jargon. However, then this is what makes this book so effective is then they go and they interview a truck driver. Right. And this guy says, I drove truck for 13 years before I worked for Walmart. After 13 years, I'd saved $700. Like that's what I left that job with. It was $700. I drove truck for Walmart for 20 years. I bought into the profit sharing because like somebody I worked with told me it was a good idea. I've been with Walmart for 20 years now. Sam Walton promised me that I would have $100,000 in profit sharing at the end of that time. Right now, my profit sharing account has $700,000 in it, right? After 20 years of driving truck for Walmart. So it is corporate jargon and corporate nonsense. Like, but you read that and you're like, I don't know. That's a blue collar dude who has a great retirement in front of him, right? So yes and no. The other thing I would say is Sam Walton
enough.
Responds to the classic criticism of Walmart is they go into these small towns, they undercut
them, yeah.
They undercut everybody, they put every mom and pop shop out of business, and they monopolize everything. Sam in this book is a little unapologetic about that, right?
Yeah, he's like, that's the open market, baby.
He's like, yeah. Look, have we done that? Is that the effect of Walmart going into a town? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, absolutely.
These lazy mom pops don't get better rates from their purveyors getting that 45% while Sam's getting 30, saving us money.
But that, and that's what he says.
Just
he
like
says,
Jeff Bezos.
He talks about the money that he has put in the pockets of these everyday citizens, right? Like how he has passed every bit of savings he ever could onto the yeah. eventual consumer.
All right, all
and how
right,
if he didn't
right,
do it, and of course
right.
this is evil people everywhere. If I didn't do it,
Somebody else
was going to.
Have done
if it,
it
wasn't
okay.
me,
I think
it would be
that's
Kmart.
Good. We're done here.
There is some kind of legitimacy to this idea that I think a lot of the anxiety about the loss of small town America is a loss of nostalgia. It's driven by nostalgia. It's a loss of something that people were nostalgic for. One wonders whether this was a phase. Like, is the small town thing designed? Is it capable of sustaining forever? Right. Or really, truly, like, as information infrastructure,
was it always gonna go away?
Yeah, right. Like, it's something which is kind of a relic of its time. It was good. I think it was good for a lot of people at a certain time, but not able to withstand the pressure of improved shipping technology, yeah. improved logistics. Like, these yeah. are things which
we're all pro Walmart, I think is what you're saying.
Yeah, no,
I
mean, yeah, we're
this
all
was this
pro.
Was my yeah. first
and
real
this,
job. I was a Walmart cashier.
You're
right?
A Walmart
really?
Guy.
I was.
I didn't know that, Ian.
What are you burying the lead here?
Yeah,
you bring
come
that's
on,
good
man.
Fodder.
I did mention it earlier in the episode. You guys just didn't
really?
Listen to
did
it.
Did you hear him at all, Joe?
I also didn't hear
just
you.
Just
I'm sure we were. I'm sure we were talking over you.
Did they teach you to lie at Walmart?
No, but they did not encourage 15-year-old me to get into the profit sharing program, which I really wish they had.
Gentlemen, welcome to Tiffany's, a safe place for you to tell me all the terrible things about your book. Without it being held against you, Joseph, what didn't you like about your book? I can't. Yeah. Even imagine anything.
So the Walmart culture that Sam Walton paints in this book is great, right? Like, it's an environment of like friendliness and down hominess and small town atmosphere and a place where ideas are embraced and creativity. But like, we've all been in a Walmart and they don't feel like that at all.
Okay.
Like, they don't feel down homey and friendly. And it's just like
distorted view of reality. Ian,
has this changed in the last 25, 35 years? Or
did it used
was
to be nice?
He just totally delusional about this?
It yes. probably used to be nice in like the heyday of store department stores, which was like what, the 80s. It's like
sure.
good for a couple years.
Yeah.
Ian, what didn't you like about your book? Sounds kind of boring, Ian.
It was not boring. It was riveting. What okay. I didn't like about it was my recurring interest in doing the biographical reading. I wish that somebody who hadn't had a public divorce
read this great this. Book.
Just like if this book had been written by some random person, right? I would be more okay with it. But the fact that like you just it's like Nick, you always say with nonfiction that's based or fiction that's based on fact, where is the line? How do you know? And
yeah,
you
just couldn't.
Just, Mackenzie, if you're listening, I really want to know.
She's not
is
listening.
Jeff Bezos that character?
Joe, I don't think you lose. I don't think I would need to read this book. You just pretty much told us, I think, everything in this book.
Yeah, I think yeah, I've done a very good job of summarizing.
Pretty much. I mean, it's maybe an interesting story, but what the I don't give a shit about Walmart.
This,
at all.
Yeah, this
like
this book is like
they
really
don't deserve
popular.
Any amount of my time. They are a store. I hate this corporate personality thing.
It's
Ian,
like the
congratulations.
Congratulations. Yay.
Yes, this is a trend now with movies that are not documentaries. Yeah. They're kind of like biopics, but biopics of companies. Like there was a Nike movie. Yeah. There's a BlackBerry movie coming out.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty good.
It's like, I mean, I understand when you get a documentary or when you get a movie about like the life of Steve Jobs, because he was an interesting dude, but
like a person.
Don't give companies their own movies. Come on.
Wow. We just gave billionaires their own episodes. So
perfect. All right. Congratulations. Mackenzie Scott, we think you're one of the one. I mean, as we know, there are no ethical billionaires. As we know, eat the rich. And Sam Walton, I am so sorry to dishonor your memory. I hope you don't come and haunt me from beyond the grave. All right, congratulations, everybody. Litheads, if you want to support the show, you can head on over to tweenvogue.com. tweenvogue.com. Suggest a
bootstraps.
Book. Suggest
bootstraps a department of Walmart.
We should. We got to get that store up. Bootstraps.
We
got to
sell bootstraps. Let's sell some bootstraps. Hey, maybe that's a 200th episode option.
Bootstraps. Maybe. You can rate, review, etc. on the podcast player of your choice. But of course, the number one thing you can do to help the show is to tell a bookish friend about it. Congratulations, Ian. Congratulations, Mackenzie Scott. Sorry, Walmart.
All right. I'm going to read a quote. I'm going to read. Scott is a signatory of the Giving Pledge, which is Bill Gates and a couple of other people, Warren Buffett, got this, put together this initiative to for billionaires to give away more than half of their wealth. This is not binding, but people sign it. They sign on and they say, I'm going to give away more than half of my wealth. And when you sign it, you have to write a letter. So this is the letter that Scott wrote. And I kind of like it because it feels, I don't know, maybe it's crafted to feel authentic. It feels less skeezy. She says, thinking about the Giving Pledge, my mind kept searching its folds for a passage I once read about writing. Something about not saving our best ideas for later chapters, about using them now. I found it this morning on a shelf of my books from college, toward the end of Annie Dillard's The Writing Life. It was underlined and starred like all of the words that have inspired me most over the years. Words that felt true in context and also true in life. And she quotes it, "Do not hoard what seems good for a later place in the book or for another book. The impulse to save something good for a better place later is the signal to spend it now. Something more will arise for later, something better. Anything you do not give freely and abundantly becomes lost to you. You open your safe and find ashes." She continues, "I have no doubt that tremendous value comes when people act quickly on the impulse to give. No drive has more positive ripple effects than the desire to be of service. There are lots of resources each of us can pull from our safes to share with others. Time, attention, knowledge, patience, creativity, talent, effort, humor, compassion. And sure enough, something greater rises up every time we give. The easy breathing of a friend we sit with when we had other plans. The relief on our child's face when we share the story of our own mistake. Laughter at the well-timed joke we tell to someone who is crying. The excitement of the kids in the school we send books to. The safety of the families who sleep in the shelters we fund. These immediate results are only the beginning. Their value keeps multiplying and spreading in ways we may never know. We each come by the gifts we have to offer, by an infinite series of influences and lucky breaks we can never fully understand. In addition to whatever assets life has nurtured in me, I have a disproportionate amount of money to share. My approach to philanthropy will continue to be thoughtful. It will take time and effort and care. But I won't wait, and I will keep at it until the safe is empty.